Welcome to Spot Diagnosis, a podcast about all things to do with dermatology, brought to you by the Skin Health Institute in Melbourne, Australia. My name is Dr. Lakshmi Iyengar, and I'm an Education and Research Fellow at the Skin Health Institute. I begin today by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Eastern Kulin Nation, traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today. We have a very exciting topic in store for you. Today's podcast will be on all things to do with the skin and the gut. In other words, cutaneous manifestations of gastrointestinal disease. As usual, we have an expert panel in the studio today. Our regular listeners will need no introduction to Professor Alvin Chong, the creator of Spot Diagnosis. Alvin is a specialist dermatologist at St. Vincent's Hospital and head of the transplant clinic at the Skin Health Institute.
Thanks, Lakshmi. Greetings, everyone. I am delighted to introduce our guest today, Dr. Luke Crantock. Luke is a specialist gastroenterologist who currently works in Melbourne, Australia. His special interest areas include bowel cancer prevention and screening, celiac disease, and video capsule endoscopy. Some of you avid podcast listeners out there may know that Dr. Luke Crantock has his own medical education podcast. It's called Everyday Medicine with Dr. Luke. It has some great insights on a broad range of topics. Luke, it is great to have you here today, and thank you for your time and expertise.
Well, thank you very much, Alvin and Lakshmi. It's a real honor to be here. I've been looking forward to this for some months, so I can't wait to cover some of the interesting topics that we have for people to listen to today.
The relationship between the skin and the gut is fascinating, and I have heard about the concept of the gut-skin axis, evidenced by the fact that many diseases that affect the gut also affect the skin. Luke, I was wondering if you could please elaborate on this for our listeners.
Well, thank you, Lakshmi. This is a very interesting area, and it's an area of sort of growing research, but I think we have to respect that we've got these two very big epithelial surfaces. We've got the skin, maybe 25 square metres, the gut, maybe 30 square metres, and they are teeming with a whole menagerie of microbiota. And the microbiota in the gut, it's really like an endocrine organ. It produces short-chain fatty acids and GABA, butyric acid. It's communicating with the cells around it. And it seems that the immune system of the gut is also linked primarily with the skin. And I don't think this has been completely worked out. It's an area of research. But we've got this bidirectional relationship between the skin and the gut. And therefore, some conditions that affect the gut certainly affect the skin and vice versa. And I think this is very interesting. One of the potential offshoots of this is that we may be able to find some kind of probiotic, something with more broad-ranging bacteria, for example, than we have currently available commercially, that maybe could have some positive influence on both the gut microbiome and then subsequently the skin microbiome. So it's an area of research, and I think it's something we just have to be aware of and await the future with great expectations.
There are numerous cutaneous manifestations of gastrointestinal disease, and I might start off with celiac disease, Luke, especially as it's a topic near and dear to your heart. Just to recap for our listeners, approximately 1% of Australians suffer from celiac disease. It is known as a gluten-sensitive enteropathy because it is an autoimmune disease characterized by antibodies in response to gluten consumption in genetically susceptible individuals with the HLA haplotypes DQ2 or DQ8. Luke, can you tell us a bit about the clinical manifestations of celiac disease and how it is diagnosed?
Thank you, Lakshmi. So we have the kind of classic set of symptoms that we think about with celiac disease, which include a patient presenting with fatigue, bloating, perhaps passing excessive wind, having loose stools, weight loss, just general malaise, aching muscles and so forth. That patient may have an iron deficiency picture. They may have had difficulty falling pregnant if they're a female. They may have presented with something a bit perhaps less commonly thought about, like an osteoporotic fracture at a younger age. And occasionally they'll present with some rather unusual things like ataxia, so some unusual neurological symptoms. And we'll talk, I'm sure, about the very characteristic rash that's critical for us to be aware of. And I look forward to Alvin's communication about that with us in a moment. I think that it must be also recognised that up to 80% of patients with celiac disease are undiagnosed. And the sort of silent celiac population is maybe seven times as common as those with these sort of characteristic finding. So it may well be that a patient will present with a itchy rash on the extensor surfaces, and that might be the first presentation that we are going to see with celiac. But we have to be aware of it. It is a very, very common condition. And although the prospect of a gluten-free diet isn't something everyone welcomes, it's eminently treatable.
Can I ask you a question then?
Sure.
What happens to these undiagnosed celiacs, 70%?
Yeah, so look, I think that these patients, probably some of those patients will be diagnosed over a period of time, later and later as their life progresses. Someone tweaks that they've got an iron deficiency picture and the appropriate diagnosis is made. It may be that some of those patients will be told for a long, long period of time that they've just got irritable bowel and they'll be diagnosed with that and sort of left to their own devices. Of course, the patients that are sickest, who have the more major clinical features, are the ones that are going to present. The ones that are not so unwell, that sort of silent majority of patients, you might say, well, they're not going to die of the condition, but they're just going to be troubled by symptoms for the majority of their life if they're not given the appropriate diagnosis and treatment strategies.
Luke, could we talk a bit about how celiac disease is diagnosed?
Yeah, so the classic way in which we diagnose it is with serological testing, so some very specific blood testing that I think we're going to come to in a moment, and also the definitive test, like the gold standard, is gastroscopy, and then biopsies are taken of the small intestine, the first and second parts of the small intestine, and we're looking for some very characteristic changes under the microscope with villi, the little projections that we see in the small intestine under the microscope, about a millimetre tall, get very flattened and full of inflammatory cells. So we've got this atrophic appearance under the microscope. And there are some other conditions that can present similarly, like giardiasis and Whipple's disease and tropical sprue. There are some unusual things that we don't really see very much here in Australia. But that appearance, particularly taken with the positive serology, is diagnostic.
Could we talk a little bit about the serology tests used to diagnose celiac disease?
Yeah, so these have improved a lot. You know, when I was a medical student, we really had very poor testing, but it's become highly refined. And we have two tests that most of us think about when we're considering celiac disease. There's the deamidated IgG anti-gliadin antibody, and there's the tissue transglutaminase antibody, which is an IgA. And it's often helpful for us to do a total IgA assessment as well, because 3-5% of patients with celiac disease are IgA deficient, and you might therefore miss the TDG, the transglutaminase antibody, in that group of patients. But they're the two tests that we do. And we'll look at the iron levels. We'll look at the ferritin and the serum iron. We might look at the serum albumin as well. And we might do the vitamin D and the folate. And occasionally the vitamin B12 is affected, but not so commonly. So they're the sorts of tests that we do in our workup.
A cutaneous manifestation that affects many patients with celiac disease is dermatitis herpetiformis. Have you seen much dermatitis herpetiformis in your patients with celiac disease?
Well, I probably have missed it, I suspect, a few times, because when patients come in and have a gastroscopy, they're generally reasonably covered up with a gown, and often the patient won't make much reference to their skin. They might just have thought they had a dermatitis and they didn't want to trouble the doctor. So I saw I have missed it several times, but I remember vividly a case some years ago. It was actually a lady that came in and looked at the skin. There she is. She's got some dyspeptic symptoms, we'll call it, a bit of bloating and nothing really too much, but on her skin she had this rash characteristic of dermatitis herpetiformis, and sure enough, even with the eye, we could see that a small bowel was atrophic. So we do see it for sure. Of course, we have to be aware, vigilant, probably not as much as the quoted incidence seems to be.
Why do patients with celiac disease get dermatitis herpetiformis?
Well, we mentioned that we have in the pathogenesis of this condition a reaction with certain haplotypes. So just to back it up a little bit, we've got the main problem we have with celiac disease is the reaction to gluten. And one of the components of gluten is gliadin. And there's an alcohol component of that. And if you break down the gliadin and have it absorbed, it's very immunogenic. And this tissue transglutaminase enzyme, which is in the lamina propria of the small bowel, but it's also in the skin, converts glutamine to glutamic acid. That's very immunogenic. It reacts with those haplotypes, and the immune cells now become very active, and the immune process that we see, which is manifested as celiac disease, evolves. So there's a cascade of inflammatory changes leading to the villus atrophy we mentioned earlier. Now, specifically in the small gut, it seems to be the tissue transglutaminase 2, whereas in the skin, there's a tissue transglutaminase 2 and 3. And there are different tissue transglutaminases, it seems, in the placenta, which might lead to problems with conception and so forth. So I think it's very interesting. That seems to be the pathogenesis, which again is across both skin and gut.
Alvin, our listeners have gotten used to you elaborating medical terms. Can you tell us why this rash is called dermatitis herpetiformis?
Yeah, sure. So dermatitis is inflammation of the skin. Actually, herpetiformis is kind of like snake-like, right? So it's also in reference to the herpes simplex infection, because when you actually have dermatitis herpetiformis, you can get small little vesicles and they're like a mimic of herpes, especially in clusters. So I think that's where they derived this name from. But I'm actually really fascinated by the pathogenesis, Luke. It's you explained it very, very clearly. So it's kind of like cross-reactivity of the antigen in both the gut and the skin, which, you know, is actually the mechanism for a lot of how these gut things actually affect skin as well.
Alvin, can you please describe the clinical presentation of dermatitis herpetiformis?
Yes, I can. This is one of the great polymorphous, chronic, difficult to diagnose dermatoses out there. In my career, I've diagnosed maybe about 4 cases, and one I actually misdiagnosed as psoriasis for like months and months before the penny dropped. It's actually very, very difficult to diagnose. So if you go, all right, classically, it presents as a very pruritic, it's symmetrical, and sometimes it's blistering, but sometimes the blisters are so itchy that the patient just bursts them, and then they just look like scratches all over the body, right? It is also fairly characteristic, and it tends to localize to extensor surfaces, so elbows, knees, buttocks. So it's no surprise that one of my celiac disease patients, I had misdiagnosed as psoriasis because he had an itchy rash in extensor surfaces. And I was wondering, how come they weren't getting better with conventional psoriasis treatment? And then until the penny dropped, and one of my colleagues did a biopsy and called me up and said, hey, your patient has celiac disease, and that's like serious egg on my face. But it just tells you that even specialists can get it wrong sometimes. Sometimes you can present like urticaria, but more often than not, it is a really chronic pruritic rash that is very, very difficult to control. So if you find an itchy rash, that topical steroids aren't working, phototherapy aren't working, you just go, what is going on? You have to think about celiac disease. The differential diagnosis is very, very wide. You've got psoriasis, you've got eczema. And again, you always think about scabies when you have patients with intractable itchy rashes. But, you know, when everything else is missing, you start to really pay attention, ask about gut history, and we just have to kind of tune ourselves into the possibility it might be dermatitis herpetiformis.
Can you get dermatitis herpetiformis in the absence of celiac disease?
You know, this one is quite controversial. I actually am not 100% certain. What about you, Luke? What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting one. It is a bit controversial. My understanding of this topic is that about 90% or more of people with dermatitis herpetiformis have something you'll find histologically in the small bowel, but they may not necessarily have very widespread atrophic changes. But I don't know. I suppose one would have to follow those patients for a long period of time. Generally, they're going to be treated and they're probably put on a gluten-free diet, so you'd never know if it was 100% or not. I always feel reluctant to say something's 100% in medicine. You always seem to get egg on your face when you say that. I'm sure there are exceptions, but it's common.
How do you diagnose dermatitis herpetiformis?
If you have a patient with known celiac disease or gluten-sensitive enteropathy and got an itchy rash, so that's dermatitis herpetiformis. It's quite easy. But if you actually don't, then you actually require a clinical pathological correlation. So clinically, does it look like it? And we do histopathology we do biopsies for direct H&E histopathological analysis and also direct immunofluorescence. If you can find an intact vesicle, biopsy the vesicle and send it off in formalin, and histologically, what you want to see is some spongiosis, a subepidermal blister with a very dense neutrophilic infiltrate. But the clincher is the immunofluorescence. So if you biopsy perilesional skin, so next to the vesicle, and you send it off in like saline-soaked gauze, the pathologist can then do direct immunofluorescence and we can find either linear or granular IgA staining of the basement membrane. You've clinched the diagnosis. So it is IgA, you know, so quite similar to the gut, isn't it, Luke?
Yes.
So the same kind of immunoglobulin in the skin and the gut.
What is the treatment of dermatitis herpetiformis?
I think the first thing is gluten-free diet, right? But in my experience, if you actually try to get a relief with gluten-free diet, it can take months and months, and even up to a couple of years before the gluten is kind of cleared from the skin. So it's very, very, it's slow, but you have to have the gluten-free diet to make sure it doesn't relapse. Clinically, if you want a faster response, we use Dapsone. And Dapsone is an interesting and odd treatment. We can use topical steroids. Sometimes we even occasionally have to immunosuppress patients, but Dapsone is the key.
That's interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about Dapsone and how it might work for dermatologic conditions such as dermatitis herpetiformis?
Yeah, so it's a substance called a sulfone, and the mechanism of action is that it is quite strongly anti-neutrophilic and anti-inflammatory. But it is a really tricky medication to use because of the presence of G6PD. You have to do a G6PD screen because if you give it to a patient with G6PD deficiency, you get quite nasty hemolysis. We use Dapsone in a small dose, 20 to 50 milligrams a day. And if the diagnosis is right, the patient often improves within days. And then you also have to make sure that they go on a gluten-free diet. So great. So we've learned about dermatitis herpetiformis, which is a manifestation of celiac disease. And we know how to diagnose it. Well, if we're lucky, you know, histology and immunofluorescence. But I think the overall thing is it's a clue that there might be something going on underneath and inside. So patients that we suspect has DH, dermatitis herpetiformis, we should really refer off to a gastroenterologist for further assessment. Is that right, Luke?
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you very much, Alvin. Yes, I think all these patients need to be subject to a small bowel biopsy via gastroscope, and then we can clinch the changes in the small intestinal anatomy. And that will also give the patients the impetus and I think the confidence to be on their gluten-free diet long-term.
Forever and ever and ever.
It's a long time, unfortunately. I'm sorry, yes. But there's wonderful gluten-free food out there too, Alvin.
Thanks for that.
Ever wondered what the Skin Health Institute does? At the Skin Health Institute based in Melbourne, we aim to improve skin health for all our patients, and the research we conduct shapes clinical treatment and practice. We provide over 30,000 patient treatments each year and also deliver exceptional education programs for dermatologists, registrars and healthcare workers. We provide specialist training for visiting international medical graduates, workshops to upskill GPs and medical students, and public education programs aimed at improving skin health in the community. The Institute also conducts clinical trials and research projects that are published and presented internationally. We make substantial contributions to the worldwide clinical care and management of skin diseases, skin cancer and melanoma, and are recognized globally for our medical research. We have multiple clinics for GPs to directly refer patients to. GPs can complete our online referral form available on our website at skinhealthinstitute.org.au/patient-referrals or email referrals to referrals@skinhealthinstitute.org.au.
Now, moving on from celiac disease, let's talk about other diseases affecting the skin and the gut. Inflammatory bowel disease has a well-established association with cutaneous manifestations. In fact, 20% of patients with IBD are affected by these skin conditions. Luke, do patients with inflammatory bowel disease present with associated skin disease as a result of inflammation in their gut? And why does IBD present this way?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's a complex question because we have lots of different sorts of skin manifestations associated with inflammatory bowel disease. And I'm sure Alvin will be discussing these in a disease-specific kind of immunological process can occur in the skin as it does in the gut. In other cases, are associated skin diseases that are related to the medications that we're using, a broad range. And sometimes a patient will come in and they'll have skin manifestations that are troubling them. For example, and we'll talk about this in a moment, a sore red 20 centimeter or so size lesion on their shin, for example, erythema nodosum. And they may not really have, at that point, very many gut symptoms. But if you probe a little bit, and often, you know, a bright primary practitioner will refer the patient on, if you probe a little bit, you'll start finding actually they do have some GI symptoms. There are situations in which those skin manifestations will precede the presentation of any sort of gut complaint. In the condition I just mentioned, erythema nodosum, it often does run parallel, but there's another condition that we'll be talking about called pyoderma gangrenosum, which may precede. And we just have to, again, think about these skin conditions in relation to the gut because of this incredible relationship between these two epithelial surfaces.
What are the cutaneous manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease?
Well, if you kind of read the textbooks, you classify them either as specific lesions, and that means the same process which is involving the gut is also involving the skin, or a reactive lesion, which is thought to be more autoimmune reaction, probably due to cross-antigenicity between the gut and the skin. I want to talk about specific lesions, all right? So let's think about Crohn's colitis, which is granulomatous inflammation. Now, Crohn's colitis can actually result in quite a lot of specific lesions. You can have fissures and fistula around the peroanal area that is granulomatous, and it can be also lead to abscesses and chronic pain and granulomatous inflammation. But interestingly, Crohn's colitis can skip the gut or be part of the upper GI and involve the oral mucosa, and then you get oral Crohn's disease. Apparently, about 20% of patients have oral mucosa involvement, where you get aphthous stomatitis, pallid stomatitis vegetans, angulocolitis, ulceration, very nasty oral disease. And then you have metastatic Crohn's disease, which I've seen, and it is really, really odd. A patient with Crohn's disease suddenly gets a sore somewhere on their skin, which is like non-specific area of inflammation, ulceration. You do a biopsy, it's granulomatous. So we call that metastatic Crohn's disease. So I think Crohn's disease can manifest, you know, in several ways. Have you seen much of that, Luke?
Well, not so much that metastatic Crohn's disease, but I'm just wondering, you know, thinking about all this, how many cases I've potentially missed that I might have looked at a skin lesion and not really thought very much of it. And again, I think probably for the myself, gastroenterological colleagues, we need to be really aware of this and perhaps having a high index of suspicion and a lower threshold for referring to, you know, experts like yourself for biopsy and further interrogation, because it can be very distressing for patients who've got these skin conditions. But often they're so overwhelmed as the condition progresses with all their gut manifestations that, you know, the skin sort of becomes like, you know, the poor relation, whereas, you know, it's often something that they are actually very mindful of in a personal sense.
How about reactive lesions?
Yeah, well, the reactive lesions are what we've alluded to earlier, you know, due to cross-antigenicity. And they're seen in both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's colitis. And there are two big ones, okay? So the first is erythematosum and pyoderma gangrenosum. So we talk about erythematosum first. This is well known. It can present in about 4 to 6% of patients with inflammatory bowel disease, sometimes associated with fevers and chills and arthralgia. And you got this typical erythematosum picture, which is like sore, tender lumps that appear on the front of the legs, about 1 to 2 centimeters in diameter. And, you know, they're painful and chronic and sometimes not so easily diagnosed. People think that they've just, you know, hit their knee and they've got this bruise that's just not healing. They often, you know, the way to make the diagnosis is to do an incisional biopsy, which is pretty tough. And it can actually mirror the inflammatory bowel disease activity. Now, so you got erythematosum, which is kind of, you know, tender, but not too bad, right? And then on the other side of it, you have pyoderma gangrenosum. And this is a nightmare because they first present as pustules, and the pustules break down, then you get ulcers. Then the ulcers keep growing and growing and growing. And sometimes they reach into bone and nothing seems to control it. You know, antibiotics don't work. The only way you can control these is with heavy, heavy immunosuppression. So at St. Vincent's, my colleague Rob Kelly has a particular interest in pyoderma gangrenosum, and they are no doubt the sickest patients and the most complicated, because when you immunosuppress them so hard, they invariably get septic, you know, so nasty disease.
Alvin, I want to ask you, there's a term I read, pathogy.
Yes,
relating to trauma and these conditions, these lesions developing. Can you make a comment about that?
Yeah, so pathogies, if you have a disease process like inflammation, and a disease that has pathogy means that if you injure the skin, the process starts at the site of injury, okay? So really classic is pyoderma gangrenosum. So what happens is these patients come in and they got this ulcer that's rapidly growing and everyone's alarm bells are ringing saying, oh my God, we got necrotizing fasciitis, we have to debride. So they go in there, they scrape the whole thing off and it gets much worse. We basically want to triple the size of pyoderma gangrenosum, you do just that. So it's a disease process getting worse with injury. And pyoderma gangrenosum is nasty for that.
Following on from that, does treating underlying IBD control extra-intestinal manifestations?
Generally, that's the observation. Certainly with erythematosum, this tends to respond quite quickly to immunosuppression, and it might just be the use of a short pulse of steroid. Now, we have in our armamentarium this wonderful group of biologic agents and small molecules that have come along, and it's really made a huge difference to the way we manage inflammatory bowel disease. And we're seeing, I think, less of these skin conditions in primary practice now because we're getting on top of the inflammatory condition earlier. And I think most clinicians now are very clued up to early, reasonably aggressive treatment of inflammatory bowel disease and progression to biologic agents and small molecules when our Medicare system allows us to activate those drugs. So we're seeing less of these products, and I think this has given us a better handle in controlling these conditions.
Yeah, I agree with that, Luke. I used to see a lot of pyoderma gangrenosum from patients with inflammatory bowel disease. This was 10 years ago, but over the last 10 years, hardly any. And I suspect it's because they are getting better and better controlled.
Yes, I think the other thing that we see when we are relying a little too heavily on steroids is acne, which, you know, I suspect patients refer to you for that, Alvin. And that's a very distressing concern for certainly younger patients. And there's a possibility of some patients developing rashes, of course, with the use of our therapies and being a little sensitized to the sun if they're using azathioprine, for example, or developing a rash with biologic agents. And we have to be very aware of the sorts of secondary rashes that can develop in relation to the very treatments that we're invoking to get our patients better and healed.
I think just touching on that, there are two things that we want to talk about with therapy, one of which is using TNF-alpha inhibitors. A small proportion of patients actually get a paradoxical psoriasiform rash. So you get psoriasis from TNF-alpha inhibitors, which is what, you know, that's how we treat psoriasis. But sometimes it can paradoxically come up. And then the second thing is I run a immunosuppression skin clinic at the Skin Health Institute, and we see quite a lot of gastroenterological patients who are on long-term immunosuppression. They're starting to get skin cancers. So just the sequelae of, you know, a purine inhibitor used over years and years is cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, which is a real problem.
Should we all as clinicians be thinking, well, we'll try and use some nicotinamide here to perhaps stave off SCCs and BCCs in our patients that are immunosuppressed with purine?
We just had a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine about 6 months ago where we had a trial of nicotinamide in transplant recipients, heavily immunosuppressed, and it doesn't work in those patients. Okay, so it's almost like the carcinogenic push in immunosuppression is so strong that nicotinamide is not enough to hold them. It tends to work in immunocompetent, but not immunosuppressed patients.
Right, okay, yeah. That's interesting.
Sorry. I wish it was else. I wish we could find that it was, and it's like, oh, wonderful, but we're having a hard time trying to convince our other colleagues to stop.
I've actually been taking nicotinamide, Alvin, and I have to.
Yeah. But you're immunocompetent. You're good.
I think I'm. Well, maybe not that competent.
Any last words to wrap up IBD?
Oh, yeah. Can you tell us about vedolizumab?
Well, that's an interesting product as well. I love vedolizumab, but it is gut specific. And so when we're thinking about patients who've got, you know, combined skin and GI pathologies, maybe vedolizumab won't be the drug that we should first go for. At least we should be aware it's not going to have any potential benefits, as I understand it, in relation to the skin because of its gut-specific effects. I'm not sure what your take is on that, whether you've... Am I wrong? That's my understanding of it.
Look, my favorite biologic to use in patients with combined inflammatory bowel disease and like psoriasis is a IL-23 blocker, okay? So like iscitinimab, fantastic. It works in both gut, works in both skin, works in psoriatic arthritis. So some of these biologic drugs have great kind of cross-organ potential.
Oh, it's very important for us to remember that when we're clinicians and we're choosing our therapies.
I would much prefer my inflammatory bowel disease patients be on a good biologic rather than a purine inhibitor right now.
Yes, yeah. Agreed.
Okay, so let's move on to another relentless, unforgiving skin condition that affects patients with liver disease due to various etiologies, and that is itch, which can be the bane of one's existence. Luke, how and why does liver disease cause itch?
Well, this is a real problem for some of our patients who've got cholestatic liver disease. So we're talking about patients who've got primary biliary cholangiopathy, PSC, primary sclerosing cholangiopathy, intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, or just liver failure where there's a lot of cholestasis. So not every liver failure is going to have that, but liver failure with cholestasis. You'll also see in patients who've got biliary obstruction from a stone or a tumour without liver failure. And once they start developing this cholestatic picture and they are retaining bile salts, it seems to be the bile salts that cause this intense itchiness. And there have been studies done where people with cholestasis have been given oral bile salts and the itch has got a lot worse. Bile salts have been injected under the skin. I guess no great surprise. It's made people very itchy. So it seems to be the bile salts predominantly that are causing this problem.
Are there any treatments that can be prescribed for itch associated with liver disease?
Well, we always try and manage the underlying problem as best as we can. So with that PBC, PSC, whatever it might be, we're trying to manage that condition, getting rid of a stone from a bile duct. Patients can have their itch resolved very, very quickly when they're cholestatic from that problem. But in terms of medications, we would use a product like Questran, which are bile salt sequestrating agents. Not everyone likes Questran. They sometimes describe it as tasting like beach sand. So we have to just mix it with something like a bit of orange juice or whatever to encourage them to have that. But Questran's very effective. The SSRIs tend to affect the sensation of itchiness a little bit. So we might think about using those. Rifampicin can be used, turn off bile duct production. Generally, antihistamines, my understanding is that they're not all that effective and they're often prescribed but not super effective. I've seen people apply Marlanta to the skin when people are super itchy. It's a bit of an unusual thing, seeing someone come in with Marlanta all over their skin. But they're the sort of things that we turn to.
I think just generally as a dermatologist, yeah, it's a hard one. But, you know, general aspects like emollient, soap avoidance, they can be useful. Is Questran also the oxycholic acid?
No.
So that's the other
cholestyramine. So acetoxycholic acid is what we would use to treat some of these conditions as the primary, some of these situations as the primary drug. But the question is it's the binding agent. So we would certainly try and manage the underlying clinical problem. And ursodeoxycholic acid might be one of the drugs that we would choose, certainly for PBC, probably not PSC. The Questran is the more active, binding reason. It's going to give us a better and more immediate effect in controlling the itch, which is, very distressing for patients. You see them coming in, they're almost bleeding from their skin. They're so itchy. Got to put gloves on their hands, pretty much. I haven't done that, actually. But, to stop them tearing at their skin, it's a terrible condition for them.
Alvin, are there any treatments from a dermatologist point of view that can be prescribed for itch caused by liver disease?
No. We're really, apart from just managing, their skin, you can actually, anecdotally, some patients have tried phototherapy, but generally, if you don't treat the underlying hepatic disease, it's not going to work.
Luke, could we please touch on some other cutaneous stigmata of liver disease?
Well, we've got things like cholinichia that we'll get bruising with patients. Someone might come in. I don't think they're going to be referred necessarily to a dermatologist with bruising, but we might see that little petechiae of the skin and bruising. In some situations, we have to be aware that we might be seeing in the skin a very specific manifestation of a particular liver disease, for example, like hemochromatosis, or sort of bronzing of the skin. And it might make us think about looking at the iron profile and diagnosing that condition. Some of these patients, of course, are given treatments, again, which do cause skin conditions. They might get Cushing or if they're given lots of steroids, whatever their underlying clinical condition is. They're sort of the main things, the palm erythema in someone who consumes alcohol. It's something we also, I think, all learn as medical students, but they're the main sorts of things that we consider.
Alvin, if the underlying disease is treated, what further treatments are there for the stigmata of liver disease?
If you have a lot of spider nevi, they can be lasered. Other than that, not a lot.
There is an important disorder where skin signs can lead to the discovery of internal gastrointestinal malignancies. Can we talk about Muir-Torr syndrome? Firstly, what is it?
Well, this is a syndrome that we don't really see in clinical medicine all that often, but it's fascinating. Like a lot of the hereditary syndromes that have to do with cancer, it's an extremely important one to recognise because of its relationship between skin and gut. And people will know about familial adenomatous polyposis syndrome, which is a disorder, an autosomal disorder on chromosome 5. Separate to that, we have a different genetic disorder, which is called Lynch syndrome or the non-polyposis colorectal cancer syndrome. And there are 5 mutations that have been described across 4 different chromosomes that have to do with this condition. And what this is It's a mutation that occurs in the sort of repair areas of DNA. So the so-called mismatch repair abnormalities occur. And as a consequence of that, you'll develop mutations, which over a period of time, sadly, lead to the progression to colorectal cancer, but not just colorectal cancer, also upper GI cancers, uterine cancers, ovarian cancers, pancreatic cancers, cancers of the, there's about 12 cancers, cancers of the bladder, cancers of the urethra, and renal carcinoma. And in some, there's a particular condition where you also get neurological cancers developing. And in this particular syndrome, which accounts for a small number, like 1-3% of the Lynch cases, the Muir-Torre syndrome, we have these unusual sebaceous manifestations that I'm sure Alvin will educate us on. I haven't actually ever seen one of these. I've never seen one. So I'm quite interested to see a case, you know, it's like a morbid fascination with these things. But that's the syndrome. And I guess if we see someone who's got lots of these skin conditions, we again should be thinking, well, what is your family pedigree? Because these patients often do have a family pedigree. And we generally think about three family members across two generations with a malignancy. It doesn't have to be colorectal cancer malignancy, although classically that's how we approach this. But it may be that they've had a uterine malignancy or they've had an ovarian malignancy and they're quite young. We start thinking, oh, could you have Lynch syndrome? And usually one of the patients in this pedigree is under the age of 50. Really have to be aware of it. And I think everybody now is sort of a little bit more tuned to doing genetic screening on our patients, which can be very confronting for a family and family members when we're saying, well, maybe we'll do some genetic screening. And all of a sudden they're saddled with a genetic abnormality, which, yes, will probably influence their life, save their life. But at the same time, it's almost like having this, what the sort of Damascus on their head, you know, and they've got this very big concern, like Angelina Jolie had her concerns, a different sort of lesion like BRCA. But people get very upset about these sorts of results. But they're very important for us to understand and to recognise. So it's a nice forum to discuss this unusual syndrome.
So, Luke, if you diagnose Lynch syndrome, do you need to do like a prophylactic remove of the gut?
Well, fortunately not, Alvin, but we do need to enter these patients into a very specific surveillance programs for neoplasia. And we do know that not every case of Lynch will develop colorectal carcinoma. They fix about 70% in their lifetime, but they're at risk, as mentioned, of other sorts of tumors in females, ovarian, uterine cancers, men or females, pancreatic cancer, cancers of the urogenital tract and kidneys. So we have to be very aware of all this. What we do is undertake a colonic surveillance of these patients, generally starting about the age of 25. It depends a little bit on also the age at which their first degree relative has been diagnosed with colorectal cancer, but generally about the age of 25. And patients are recommended to have that screening every year. When they're younger, we might even do it every second year, but generally every year. And we will do an upper GI scope every second year. And it's recommended that these patients also seek gynecological assistance in the female and have the appropriate workup there as well. And that may even lead to hysterectomy and oophorectomy in due course. So we don't have to progress to a colectomy. We don't do it prophylactically, but we're looking very carefully for sessile lesions and malignancies that are developing in the right colon in particular, but not specifically there. They can be anywhere in the colon, but particularly the right side.
Alvin, Luke touched on the cutaneous lesions in Muir-Torre syndrome. Could you please elaborate on this for our listeners?
Yeah, so Muir-Torre syndrome, as you know, is a subset of hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer. But they can develop cutaneous lesions in addition to the colonic polyps and internal malignancies. And these cutaneous lesions are largely sebaceous. So they're not sebaceous hyperplasia, which is just like enlargement of oral glands, but sebaceous tumors, sebaceous adenoma, sebaceoma, or sebaceous carcinoma. And clinically, they're all fairly similar. They present as nonspecific nodules on the head and neck area around the eyes, sometimes slightly yellow hue. And they can look like BCCs or squamous cell cancers, but when they're excised, histologically, they are sebaceous tumors. Now, if the immunohistochemistry on tumor tissue shows mismatch repair deficiency, and they can actually tell that, or microsatellite instability, then you start thinking about, is this Muir-Torre? And then we often have to then refer off for colorectal screening. So I'll send a couple your way.
Oh, thank you,
Luke.
Well, I'd be very honored to receive them as referrals.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, you know, that if you diagnose a sebaceous tumor, don't just resect it and say it's done. You know, we have to make sure that the patient doesn't have an underlying tumor syndrome.
I think that's so important in medicine, isn't it? That there are manifestations. Here we're talking about cutaneous manifestations of internal disease in relation to the gut. But as clinicians, we have to be aware that each organ is not just considered by itself. It has to be considered as part of the whole, and that we may be seeing a sign in the skin. We've talked about dermatitis herpetiformis that reflects something broader internally, and it's very important we are vigilant of that, and that we it's a curiosity, isn't it, when you're managing your patients. You have to be like Sherlock Holmes and try and think, well, what else is this really reflecting? And many times we'll be wrong, won't reflect anything. But then just occasionally you'll really make a difference to a patient's life, and it's incredibly rewarding when that happens.
Luke, is genetic counselling needed for these patients?
Yes, I think it's essential. I think it's essential that they be referred for genetic counselling. There are many genetic counselling services that are available. As I touched on earlier, I do discuss with patients that they have to be emotionally, I think, prepared also for genetic counselling, what it really means. It's like someone being told they've got the Alzheimer's gene and, you know, the EPOE4, and they may get Alzheimer's. Like, it's very confronting if someone is diagnosed with things. It doesn't always mean you're going to actually develop the clinical problem, but I think the way to couch the genetic counselling is that it's going to help provide a better future, and not just for that person, but also for their offspring. So it's very important.
I would like to discuss another very interesting topic relating to diet and the skin. There is some anecdotal evidence that a high dairy intake diet and a high GI diet can cause skin conditions such as acne. What are your thoughts on this, Luke, and why could these foods lead to acne?
Well, I think I have been somewhat of a sort of Neanderthal when it comes to sort of thinking about this in many respects. I've always been a bit cynical, which is a fault of mine. And I have to say that the evidence does suggest that there is indeed a relationship between the glycemic index of foods, how quickly they influence the blood sugar level, and your skin in relation to a whole range of things that I'm sure Alvin will touch on, like acne, for example, and so forth. And it is fascinating. You know, I think perhaps we've gone through a period of many decades where we haven't really focused on the diet so much. We've been inclined to have processed and packaged foods and not really think about eating foods that are in season. And really, the world's now going through a little bit of an awakening, I think, in regard to how important our diet is, how important it is to have low glycemic foods, foods that aren't so rich in refined carbohydrates, eating foods that are presented to us by nature that are in season. And it'll be very interesting to see how that affects some of the skin manifestations that we've talked about.
I think the two things that you pointed out, glycemic index and dairy, from a lot of research. So, by the way, if you wanted to know a little bit about misinformation, there's nothing better than diet and skin. You know, so eat this and your skin will get better. Actually, gut, that's full of misinformation too, yes. Isn't it? Eat yes. this and your gut will get better. But I think the evidence has shown that consistently, diet with high glycemic index is linked with worsening acne, and a diet that's very, very high in dairy is linked with worsening acne. The glycemic index thing is possibly got to do with growth factors. Hard to know. And certainly the dairy thing is related to growth factors. So they can actually show that high dairy intake leads to an increase in certain growth factors that act on the sebaceous glands, and they actually cause them to become more active. But, you know, if you actually had a patient with bad acne and just say, this is all you need to do is change your diet, it doesn't work. You know, it only works for a the diet probably only accounts for a very small proportion of why a patient will get severe acne. There's lots of other things. There's genetic factors, which are primarily at play. It's genetics, hormones, and a diet maybe just plays a small part of it.
It's sort of in the may help topic.
In addition to, you know, proper treatment, this may help. But I wouldn't prescribe diet as the only treatment for bad acne. Not going
to
work.
So Lakshmi and Alvin, I'd like to just very briefly mention two other conditions that I think are worth noting. And one is perhaps not so common, but it's quite dramatic when you see people with pigmentation on their lips and their buccal mucosa.
We're talking about Peutz-Jeghers.
Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, and I've had a few patients in the last month. And so that's something we have to be aware of. And I think probably because this is often highlighted in medical school, most people would be aware of that and start thinking, oh, okay, maybe there are some other manifestations like hematomas, and there's an increased GI malignancy risk and ovarian risk and pancreatic cancer risk in these patients. So that's something I'd like to mention. The other thing that I'd like to mention, I've seen quite a lot of people presenting over the last few years with this and complications of this is the ulcer render Weber syndrome. And so lots of little telangiectatic vessels that occur, and you'll see them on the lips and sometimes on the skin, but they're often scattered diffusely through the gut. And because of the way we now manage atherosclerotic disease with anticoagulants that are often quite potent, we're seeing a lot of patients present with iron deficiency anemia. And from the gastroenterological perspective, what we're often asked, would we undertake endoscopic evaluation of this patient in case they've got a malignancy? But we often will find these little telangiectatic vessels that have bled a little bit from anticoagulation. So I think in primary practice, when people are seeing these, I think, oh, okay, well, you know, that is something to be aware of and alert of, particularly as we're now using so many anticoagulants and antiplatelet agents. That's probably not a condition that generally is going to be referred to, Alvin, I suspect. But
we occasionally see them. Yep. Okay. So maybe we can wrap up with a little bit of conversation about your podcast, Luke. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, thank you, Alvin. I'm actually in awe of the Spot Diagnosis podcast, and it's a template for how to probably run a very professional podcast. Mine is far more amateurish than yours, but I started Everyday Medicine during COVID, really because I had some idle time, and I wanted to explore with my colleagues what they were up to in terms of their new developments. So there have been a lot of new developments in management of diabetes. It's a metabolic syndrome, diabetes. It's a huge issue. And I wanted to go and talk with endocrinologists about that. I wanted to talk with the cardiologists about all the interesting things that they were doing, because there's a whole range of interventions now that are really being performed daily everywhere that are making massive differences to patients' lives in terms of valve replacements done transvascularly and stenting patients and managing their hypertension and managing their lipid profile aggressively. So I fortunately was able to convince some of my colleagues, one of the best, of course, was you, Alvin, in relation to dermatology, to come and have a talk with me. And, you know, that's been an absolute privilege to gain insights into how medicine is managed by different specialties. And it's been a lovely, lovely sort of tour de force for me. And, well, it is quite time-consuming. And, you know, it's a labour of love, really. It's been, an absolute privilege to have those conversations with people such as yourself over the last couple of years.
How many episodes have you done so far?
I think we're 130 have been released.
This is just to put it into perspective. We started at the same time, okay? We launched our podcast in March 2020, right?
Right.
Right,
yes.
Okay, so,
yes.
And we've got 44 episodes. We do one a month. He does one a week. And like a one-man band. It's incredible.
Well, I've got a lot of – when I phone people, I think there's a red flag. You know, what's Crantock going to ask me to do now? But I've had some beautiful people that have responded to me from overseas. On holidays, actually, I met someone who's a Pilates expert, and she had studied under one of the world's top Pilates instructors, and she wrote a beautiful book about Pilates and rehabilitation that my wife had read. And, you know, I interviewed her. She was in Los Angeles. That was nice. And I've had, in fact, people from Israel that I've spoken to, and Canada, and one of my colleagues is a cardiologist in the United States, and it was lovely to catch up with him and have a chat with him. So I've managed to catch up with lots of people from all sorts of diverse backgrounds. It's been fantastic.
How do we listen to your podcast?
Well, it's Everyday Medicine with Dr. Luke, and that is available on every platform.
Fabulous. I encourage you guys to listen to it. It is fabulous. I've enjoyed being on it, you know, and I actually take my hat off to you, Luke, because you work four times harder than I do, for sure.
Well, I don't know about that. I think, you know, I enjoy work. And as they say, you know, if you do something you enjoy, you know, you're not really working at all. It's one of the big privileges of being a clinician.
What a fascinating discussion we've had today on such a broad range of topics. Thank you so much, Luke. That actually brings us to the end of this special episode on the skin and the gut. We would like to thank the education team at the Skin Health Institute and Balloon Tree Productions. Remember, these podcasts are not meant to replace medical advice. If you have a skin condition that requires attention, we strongly encourage you to see your medical practitioner.
For listeners who want more information on this subject, a transcript of this episode and links to other resources can be found on our website, spotdiagnosis.org.au. Please share Spot Diagnosis with your friends and colleagues. Rate and review us. Let us know what you think. We would really appreciate your feedback and any suggestions.
A quick reminder to our GP listeners that Spot Diagnosis is accredited for CPD points with RACGP and ACRM. The Skin Health Institute would like to thank our exclusive institute partner, Melbourne Pathology for their support of the Spot Diagnosis podcast, and Lily for their continued commitment to dermatology and for their support of this podcast episode.